Okay, so I will try to tie together a bunch of topics that must have been discussed in the earlier part of this summer school, though I must confess I unfortunately wasn't able to be here until yesterday, so I started hearing the talks yesterday morning. But I know that Daniel Gottesman talked about quantum error correction, and then I did hear Panos Oliveras talk about fault tolerance. But I believe that nobody talked about the passive error correction or error prevention methods, decoherency subspaces, noiseless subsystems, and the open loop methods, particular dynamical decoupling. So that will be the focus of my talk today, and I will explain how these two approaches can be joined beneficially. But I'd like to start by introducing the subject with a very simple example. The theme of this talk, the underlying theme of this talk is symmetry, how we can use symmetry to protect quantum information. And this is a purely classical example. Let's say that you're given two coins, and I've conveniently written down the four possible states of two coins here with heads and tails. And your task is to store one classical bit of information in these two coins. Now, of course, that seems very easy. I mean, you have two coins, and that's two bits. But now let's add the complication that there's a nasty little demon that is flipping these coins constantly at random. So you never have a coin that you can really rely on, except there's one feature of this demon. It can, fortunately for us, only flip the two coins simultaneously. So when it performs its random coin flip, this is what happens. Okay, so tails goes to heads, and heads goes to tails, but these four states get flipped in a symmetric way. The symmetry is a permutation symmetry. The demon cannot distinguish the two coins from one another, so if you focus at the top, the two tails becomes two heads. All right, so now the question is, how would you reliably store a single bit in this type of noise model? And a moment's reflection reveals that, of course, what you should do is you should divide the space of four states into two pairs of states, the symmetric states, or the even pairy states, which are the heads-heads and the tails-tails, because this pair of states always gets interchanged one into the other. And likewise, the odd parity states always get interchanged one into the other. So if you call this the logical zero, these two states, and you call this the logical one, you will have a protected bit of information. Okay, so here we see a very simple classical example of how using symmetry can protect us from the effects of a noisy environment. And the symmetry is, in this case, a permutation symmetry, and that is actually a very important symmetry in the storage of quantum information as well. So, as I said, the theme of this talk is to explain how symmetry allows us to protect quantum information, and I will talk about two main methods. And the first part, I'll focus on decoherency subspaces and noiseless subsystems, which basically use some kind of an existing symmetry, like this demon who can't tell left from right, to perfectly hide quantum information from an environment or a bath. So imagine that there's some kind of a protected subspace or protected corner, a quiet corner in the larger Hilbert space of the system where we can reliably store information. And in the second part, I'll talk about how to dynamically generate a symmetry when nature is not so generous as to just give us the symmetry for free. We can force it to give us a symmetry. We can generate it using a method that's been known for maybe since the 50s in NMR under the name of spin-echo, but has recently seen a revival in quantum information under the name of dynamical decoupling. It's an open loop control method, and it allows us to dynamically generate symmetries. And the way it works is roughly we apply a strong pulse, which flips things around in a system, followed by a period of free evolution, and then we apply another pulse, etc. And provided that these bangs that we apply are stronger than the system bath interaction, and provided that we do this frequently enough, faster than the bath correlation time, then it turns out that we can reliably protect information that way as well. So I'll tell you the details of that after the break. Okay, so now I'd like to be a little formal and try to give you a unified picture of the different error correction and prevention methods. I'm going to do this assuming and hoping that some of the, at least the notation that I'm using, have been covered before. And I think it's useful to give you this perspective even before we get into the details so that you will have a global view of what's going on. Okay, so here's the error model, the typical error model used in quantum information of trace preserving completely positive or just for short CP maps. So the initial state of the system is mapped via a channel into a new state, rho prime, or the action of the channel, let's denote that by E. And this is a completely positive map, which I'm sure was discussed in previous talks. Now, what is a decoherence-free subspace? Here's a formal definition of a decoherence-free subspace. Let's take the Hilbert space of the system, and let's decompose it into a direct sum of two subspaces, A and B. And now I'm going to call A decoherence-free subspace, or I'll call it a code C. The code C are all those states, rho, which act on the subspace A, such that the error map preserves rho. So that's a decoherence-free subspace. It's a subspace which is invariant under the action of the error map. Very simple. Now, this is not the most general way in which we can ask for information to be passively preserved. There's a more general notion, the notion of a noiseless subsystem. We start in the same way. So we split the Hilbert space into a sum of two subspaces, A and B. But now let's assume that, in addition, A has a tensor product structure, a bipartite tensor product structure. So there's a subsystem, not a subspace anymore. This is a subsystem, N, the noiseless one, and G for a gauge. all we need to assume is that there is this tensor product decomposition. And now what's the code? The code is all those states, rho, acting on the subspace A, which have this property. You see, this is not a preservation under the of the whole subspace, but preservation just of the left tensor factor. So what we're doing is we're assuming, or demanding rather, that after the action of the error map, if we take the partial trace over G, yeah, that's the same as if we had taken the partial trace over G to begin with. Yes? Yeah, we'll get to that. Absolutely. We'll allow unitary evolution later. That's a good point. But for now, I'm just assuming that it's indeed just storage. This is quantum storage, not quantum computation. Okay, so the notion of a subsystem is more general. Obviously, we could get the decoherence-free subspace case back if we just assumed that the right tensor factor G, the right subsystem, was just a number. Then we get the subspace, the decoherence-free subspace case back. So this is a notion, the notion of a noiseless subsystem. And you see here we're not doing anything. We're just assuming that information is protected by virtue of some symmetry, apparently. Now, a quantum error correcting code is a similar construct. Again, we have the division of the Hilbert space into two subspaces. And now, what is the code? The code, again, is all those states, rho, acting on the subspace A, such that there exists some CP map R, which is called the recovery map, for which, after the action of the channel, we can apply R to then get the state back. Okay, so that's an error correcting code. You see that here there's some action that we're taking where we have to apply the recovery map, R itself a CP map, in order to get the state back. And just like we can have a quantum error correcting code over a subspace, we can have the so-called operator quantum error correcting code, which is error correction over a subsystem. So once again, we split the Hilbert space into two subspaces, but assume that the A subspace has a tensor product structure. And now an operator quantum error correcting code is a code C, which comprises all states rho, such that there exists a CP map R, a recovery map, for which first I have to apply the recovery, but then I only I only require that after partial trace, I get the state back. Okay, so you see that there's a progression here from simple to complicated. These two are the passive case. These two are the active case. Here I have to apply the recovery map. Here I don't have to do anything. In the subsystem case, I am demanding that information is stored in a tensor factor or a subsystem. Whereas in the subspace case, I am demanding that information is stored in a whole subspace. Now, in fact, yes. Well, in fact, if you flesh out this condition, you will see that there can be no entanglement between these two. Okay, so rho will have a tensor product structure over these two. The point is that we don't care what happens to the right-hand factor. So as long as the left-hand factor is preserved, we can allow anything to happen to the right-hand factor, and that's okay. But this means that there can be no entanglement between the left and the right-hand factors. That's an outcome of this definition. Yeah, let's move on, and we'll come back to this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Case, not well
I'm sorry.
For passive case, I think well defined. For active case, it's not well defined. But this is a CP map. I can see how they're related to the capital C at all. So what's the C there? You definitely
the C.
All stay from A to A.
Uh huh.
Then how the CP map related to the C at all?
Well, okay. I mean, you're both asking me to flesh out these definitions, and I'm going to do that. Okay, okay. But these are just the definitions. Then, of course, we can derive conclusions about the structure of these codes. But for now, I just want to point out that we can think of a decoherency subspace as an error-correcting code, and vice versa, because if you look at these definitions, you see that, of course, a decoherency subspace is a quantum error correcting code with a trivial recovery operation, right? Because if I were to take R to be the identity here, I would get the DFS case back. And likewise, a quantum error correcting code is a DFS with respect to the this map. So if you think of this entire map as the error channel, then what we get back is the definition of a DFS. So there's a strong connection between decoherency subspaces and quantum error correcting codes, and likewise, there's a strong connection between noiseless subsystems and operator quantum error correcting codes in the same way. So if I simply substitute the trivial recovery operation, if I make this identity, I will get back the case of a noiseless subsystem, or if I think of R composed with E as the CP map, then an operator quantum error correcting code is a noiseless subsystem. So these concepts are all intimately related. Okay, now in order to make progress and understand the structure of these codes, we have to be more specific about the system-Bath interaction. So here is how we typically derive the notion of a CP map and various approximations to it. We start with a Hamiltonian for the system and the bath and the system-bath interaction. And the system-bath interaction can always be written as a sum of tensor products of operators acting on the system and operators acting on the bath. And then we evolved the joint system bath density matrix starting from time zero via this Hamiltonian. And if we take the partial trace over the bath, we get the system state. And provided that this state is classically correlated, the initial system bath density matrix, then we can write this in the form of a CP map. For the experts, it's well known that a sufficient condition is that rho SB is a tensor product state, but this is not a necessary condition. Turns out that there's a wider class of initially correlated states which allow for CP map structure, and these are so-called vanishing quantum discord states, which are essentially classical states, but they don't have to be uncorrelated. Anyhow, for the purposes of this talk, we can define G-coherence as non-unitary evolution of the system. So that basically means that whenever there is more than one non-trivial Krauss operator, these operators here are called Krauss operators, then this is no longer unitary evolution, and then we get decoherence. So what is decoherence? Decoherence is non-unitary evolution of the system, subject to a CP map. We can also make a... Yeah. They don't... well, yeah, the way they're written here, they have to be Hermitian, right? Yeah. Now, you can sometimes make an approximation known as the Markovian approximation, which is essentially an approximation where we assume that the bath has no memory of its interaction with the system. The bath has... is Markovian. And in that case, you can derive from this map, you can derive a differential equation, which is similar in a way to the Schrödinger equation. The blue part is the Schrödinger equation. And then there is an additional part, which is called the Lindblatian after Lindblat, though other people have also derived this equation. And the structure of this Markovian or Lindblat master equation is very convenient for analysis because this is a differential equation. You can propagate it in time. And plus, it also happens to describe a large variety of systems, especially in quantum optics and also in liquid state NMR. So this is often used as an approximation. And I would like to talk about both this exact description and this approximate description of dynamics in the context of understanding the conditions for decoherence of subspaces and noiseless subsystems. Okay, so now there was a question earlier about whether we can allow for unitary evolution on a DFS. And indeed, the previous definition that I gave of a DFS really concerned only quantum storage, but we would like to allow something more general, which is we would like to allow the state to evolve if we want to actually compute over it rather than just store. So the more general notion of a DFS, we can call a unitarily invariant DFS, is this. It's a subspace in which the evolution is purely unitary. It's not just identity. It's purely unitary. So here's the exact definition. So let's assume that the Hilbert space of the system decomposes into a direct sum. So these, again, are the two subspaces I was talking about before. I call them A and B before. Now let's call them HD and HD perp. And let's assume that the system state, the initial system state, can be partitioned into four blocks. And the blocks just correspond to this subspace structure here. And I'm interested in the upper left-hand block. And I want to assume that it is non-zero initially. Okay, so what is now a unitarily invariant DFS? It's a subspace which has the property that under the dynamics, the upper left-hand block evolves in a unitary manner. And I don't care what happens to the other three blocks, as long as the upper left-hand block evolves in a unitary manner. So this I will call a unitarily invariant DFS. Now, when can this happen, something like this? It turns out that we can find necessary and sufficient conditions, and it depends on whether we have a CP map picture or a Markovian dynamics picture or maybe a Hamiltonian dynamics picture. So let's start with the CP map picture. So here again is a CP map. And the following theorem gives a necessary and sufficient condition for this to happen, that the upper left-hand block, which belongs to this first subspace, evolves in a purely unitary manner. And the condition is simply this, that all the Krauss operators have to have this kind of structure, a block diagonal structure, and the upper left-hand block, unsurprisingly, has to be the same up to a constant for all of these Krauss operators. They all have to involve the unitary that we wish to apply, possibly times some constant, and these constants have to add up to one in this way, and that's for trace preservation. Whereas the operators B sub K are arbitrary, except that, again, they have to satisfy this, essentially, a trace preservation condition. So what this means is that the Krauss operators act in a unitary fashion on the DFS. That's what this means. And if any channel that has a structure will support a unitarily invariant DFS. I want to point out something important here, which is that there was no need to assume that we have initialized the system inside the DFS. Okay, initializing the system inside the DFS would have meant that row 2 is 0, that the block row 2 is 0. And that's not necessary. We can start with any initial state, as long as it has something in to begin with in the DFS part, so row D is not 0, any initial state, even one that is imperfectly initialized, will satisfy this unitary evolution condition, provided the Krauss operators have this form. I also have, presumably, if I have a unitary acting on the system, then I also have some control that I can apply to the system, which is what is generating this unitary. Okay. Yeah. So this idea that we can imperfectly initialize is very different from the situation in quantum error correcting codes, because quantum error correcting codes are perturbative constructions. Okay, they only work if the noise is sufficiently weak. And that also affects the initial state. The initial state should be sufficiently close to the state that we wish to protect, otherwise it doesn't work. But here we can allow for arbitrary imperfection as long as the Krauss operators are perfect. Okay, now what about the DFS, the unitarily invariant DFS conditions for master equations? They look very similar. So here again is the Markovian master equation, and it turns out that a necessary and sufficient condition for a unitarily invariant DFS is that the Lindblad operators, the F alphas, have a block diagonal structure, but now we want them all to act as identity on the DFS on the upper left-hand block. And in addition, we have to be careful about the Hamiltonian, because we should make sure that the Hamiltonian doesn't take the state outside of its protected subspace, right? So we must not have off-diagonal blocks in the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian should itself decompose into a direct sum like this. So, and again, this allows for a DFS with imperfectly initialized states. Okay, so here the meaning is that the Lindblad operators act as identity on the DFS up to a scalar, and the Hamiltonian preserves the DFS.
And are there further generalizations where you would allow the Hamiltonian to transfer against the block structure given the condition that, so to say, the outer blocks, which do the infavorable mixing process, can be refocused on a small time scale?
Yeah.
So if you can undo them.
Yeah, yeah, that's. That's right. So we'll get to that.
Okay.
Right now I'm talking about perfect information preservation, perfectly passive information preservation.
Yes. And actively you can loosen.
That's right. As soon as you can do some kind of control, whether it's open loop or closed loop, you can loosen these restrictions. Yeah. Yes, we are looking right now. We're not actually even looking yet. Right now, we're just characterizing. But the goal is absolutely to try to protect information. So, yes, the underlying theme is that we're looking for conditions under which we have protected information, in particular a protected decoherence-free subspace.
Yeah.
We're going to construct them. Right now, I'm just characterizing them. Yes.
Originally, you have a whole human space H. There's no HD at all. So you look for HD.
Yes, we're looking for HD.
Okay.
Right.
So your HD pickup may not be big enough.
Yeah, we're gonna get to the question of dimension in a second. Absolutely. Yeah, it could be that HD is, let's say, just one-dimensional, and that's not very useful, right? Storing just one state. And that's, unfortunately, generically the situation. Nature is not so generous, but sometimes it's more generous. Okay, so here is an exercise. I started by writing number one when I wrote the talk, and then I realized that I don't have number two, so this is the only homework. So you can prove the sufficiency of these two conditions, which is very easy. You just plug it in, and you see that it's verified. And then you can try to prove the necessity, which is less easy, for these two scenarios of CP maps and Markovian master equations. Okay, so now I was talking in the beginning about symmetry, and so where is the symmetry in all this? And as people have already impatiently asked, how do we find and construct these DFSs, or noiseless subsystems? By the way, the two conditions that I just described, I gave them for the case of a DFS, but there are natural generalizations also for a noiseless subsystem. Okay, so in order to understand the origin of symmetry, let's look at how all this is described when we have Hamiltonian dynamics. That's where the symmetry is most easily visible. So now what we have is a Schrödinger equation with the Hamiltonian, like before, a system Hamiltonian, a Bath Hamiltonian, and a system Bath interaction component. And now a DFS is going to be a subspace where the system Bath Hamiltonian acts trivially. In other words, we want the system Bath Hamiltonian to act as identity on the subspace and as some arbitrary operator O on the rest. Okay, and we also should not forget that the system Hamiltonian itself should not spoil the existence of the DFS. We don't want the system Hamiltonian to take states out of the DFS. Okay, so here is the theorem which characterizes when this happens. Let's consider the algebra generated by these system operators in the system Bath Hamiltonian and their Hermitian conjugates in case that they're not Hermitian. And let's throw in the identity operator as well. So this is called an associative algebra. So what I mean by the algebra is just the all polynomials in these operators. And let's assume, and this addresses the condition that the system Hamiltonian should preserve the DFS, let's assume that the system Hamiltonian commutes with this algebra. Okay, then the theorem says this. If there is a DFS, then its dimension is going to equal the degeneracy of the one-dimensional irreducible representations of this algebra. Okay, so this is a mouthful, and I'm going to explain it. But the key word to pay attention to here is the word degeneracy, because as every physicist knows, degeneracy is associated with symmetry. Symmetry leads to degeneracy, and degeneracy means that there is some symmetry, maybe a hidden symmetry. Okay, so the dimension of the DFS is going to equal the degeneracy of the one-dimensional irreducible representations of the algebra generated by A. Okay, so here's a very simple example illustrating this. It's called collective dephasing. Let's assume that we have two qubits, and they're coupled to some, let's say that these are spins, and they're coupled to a magnetic field B, which can fluctuate in time in an arbitrary manner, but like the demon in the first slide, it has a wavelength that's long compared to the spacing between these two qubits, which means that it cannot distinguish left from right. Okay, so the only way it can couple to the qubits is in a symmetric manner, which doesn't distinguish the left from the right qubit. Okay, so now what happens? Well, if I look at the state of qubit J, J is 1 or 2, let's say that this was its initial state. Under the action of this field, it is going to acquire some random phase, but this phase theta is, the important point is that it does not depend on the index J, because the field which induces the phase cannot tell 1 from 2. Okay, so that looks like there is a symmetry, so there should be some conservation and a DFS. And indeed, if we write down the interaction Hamiltonian, I meant HSB here, HSB which has, oh, and this is another typo, I'm sorry, this should have been 2, sigma z2. So if we have a system bath interaction which is the sum of sigma z1 plus sigma z2, which, and you see that this is obviously permutationally invariant, times some arbitrary bath operator, then in the basis of spin up, spin down, or in the computational basis of 0, 1 of the two qubits, this Hamiltonian is already diagonal. And you see that indeed there is a degeneracy here. That degeneracy is the signature of a DFS. What's the DFS? It's the two states up, down, and down, up. So the suggestion is that we should encode our qubit into these two states. Let's call this one logical 0 and this one logical 1, or the way I wrote it here. And now we have a protected qubit which is immune to the action of this magnetic field. Whereas the down, down, and the up, up states each acquire different phases under the action of this field. So they are not as a subspace. If I join the two blue states, they would not, as a subspace, be decoherence free because they acquire one is a minus and one has a plus phase. Okay, but these two states are degenerate in this sense of the action of this decohering field. So another way to understand what's going on is again to look at the way the states in the computational basis transform. The state 0, 0 under the action of sigma z is unchanged. The state 1, 1 under the action of this operator gets the phase e to the 2 I theta, or previously I had e to the minus I theta here and e to the plus I theta here. So the point is there's a phase difference of 2 theta between these two states, 0, 0 and 1, 1. But the state 0, 1 and 1, 0 acquire the same phase, the same e to the I theta, and therefore they do not decohere because this global phase, which I can factor out, is irrelevant. Right? It's not a measurable quantity. So if I consider any superposition of these two states, 0, 1, and 1, 0, I can factor out the global phase e to the I theta, and they will be these two states will evolve in the same manner, so we have a decoherence-free qubit. It's a two-dimensional protected subspace. I hope that's clear. This is very same as the example of the two coins I started with, except that now the other two states, 0, 0, and 1, 1, do decohere relative to one another. But here's a question. Are they also a DFS, these two states? Any ideas? Any thoughts? So what about the 0, 0, and the 1, 1 states? Are they also a DFS? So they are a DFS each separately. They each are a one-dimensional DFS. Okay, it's not a very useful DFS, but as a one-dimensional subspace, they don't change, right, up to a global phase. So we could call them a DFS, but it's a useless one. This one is the useful one because it's a two-dimensional one due to the degeneracy. So it allows us to store a whole qubit. These two allow us to store, in some sense, a half a qubit, but it's not really even half. It's 0 qubits. Okay. That's right. Yeah. So we can certainly envision a situation if I had a minus sign here and I had the indices proper, right? So 1 minus 2, then those two states would form the DFS and whereas the yellow ones would each acquire a relative phase. Okay, but in this example of only 2 qubits, there's nothing else. But if you're talking about having n qubits, again, are you talking about 2 qubits or more? Mm-hmm. Well, I characterize the general situation. So this, in this example, there are no more subspaces because it's only 2 qubits. Okay, but now I want to give the full generalization back to the idea of noiseless subsystems. So the condition for decoherence-free subspace was involved the one-dimensional irreducible representations of the algebra. By the way, I forgot to point that out, that indeed these are all one-dimensional irreducible representations. All four of them are one-dimensional irreps, right? Because you don't see anything bigger than a one-by-one block here. The more general situation, there will be bigger blocks with non-zero elements off diagonally. So here we have just one-dimensional irreps in this example. Okay. But more generally, we don't need this one-dimensional restriction. And this is what was realized by Camilla Flam and Viola back in 2000, and it was a real breakthrough. What they realized is that we can actually generalize this very significantly. We can drop the one-dimensional restriction. And here's how it works. So once again, here's the system-bath interaction. And then if we look at this associative algebra of polynomials, the one that gave rise to the one-dimensional irrep in the case of the DFS, actually there's a general structure theorem which tells us that the matrix representations of such an algebra over the Hilbert space of n qubits, so that's C2 to the power n, of n qubits here, this matrix algebra is isomorphic to the following object, a tensor sum over the index J here, where J labels the irreducible representations. So this, if you remember your angular momentum theory, it's very similar. So think of J as an angular momentum label. And then we can always write it as a tensor sum over a tensor product, where one factor has the identity matrix acting on it, and the dimension of these identity matrices is N sub J, which is the multiplicity or the degeneracy of the representation. Tensored with some arbitrary, possibly complex valued matrix, whose dimension is D sub J, the dimension of the algebra, of the J-th representation. So N sub J is the multiplicity, D sub J is the dimension of the J-th representation. And the fact that we have identity here is absolutely crucial, because the corresponding Hilbert space decomposition into a tensor sum of tensor products means that when I act with this error algebra, A is the algebra of errors in some sense, right? The thing that acts on the system and causes it to decohere. The fact that I have an identity here means that these tensor factors, these subsystems, will not change, because they're acted upon by identity. Whereas the right-hand factors will change. Okay. But we don't care. As long as we store information in the left-hand factors here, they do not decohere, again, because of the identity here. Okay, and then the question boils down to when is NJ, when are these multiplicities greater than 1? Because if they're just all 1, then we have nothing. That means that we don't have a qubit. That's just like the states 0, 0, and 1, 1 that I talked about before. Those are not qubits. Those are not logical qubits.
The condition when they are all 1 somehow reflects that they are abelian, which is probably a little too strong.
No. No. Abelian has to do with DJ, with the dimension of the representation. So in the case of in the abelian case, all the dimensions of the irreps are one-dimensional. But the degeneracy...
Exactly the condition which is not needed. You wrote that in the third line there in green. So it's not needed that the irreducible representations are one-dimensional, which means they're completely abelian. The only thing which you really do need is, so to say, that they centralize or normalize the subspace in which you want to work.
Okay, the notion of abelian is, I think, might be a little confusing. So let's, in the interest of time, let's not press this point. But to make sure that we're on the same page, so an abelian algebra would have only one-dimensional representations, but they could be highly degenerate. Okay, just like I gave you an example with 2 qubits, there was an abelian case, one-dimensional representations which were doubly degenerate. Those were the two states up, down, down, up. They're degenerate. Okay, so the degeneracy, we encode into the degeneracy, so to speak. The The size of the degeneracy is exactly the dimension of the protected subsystem. Okay, and again, symmetry implies that there will be some degeneracy, some non-trivial degeneracy with nj greater than 1. So each one of these irrep labels, j, labels an n sub j dimensional noiseless subsystem code. Each one of these factors here is a noiseless subsystem code whose dimension is n sub j. The DFS case is the case of d sub j being 1 when we have a one-dimensional irreducible representation, which can still be degenerate. Okay? So, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, so in physics, is that realistic? I mean, in the sense that as you decrease the size of the system, you may have more channels for the system.
Yes.
Critical here.
Yes.
So you're probably also decrease the associated algebra.
You're absolutely correct. So this is math. This is not physics yet, and we'll get to the physics and symmetry breaking and what to do about symmetry breaking. Okay. But right now, we're just trying to understand, get an understanding of the mathematical structure of this theory, which will give rise to protected units of information. Okay, so now that we have this beautiful structure theorem here, it also gives us insight into the question of computation. So you might remember that from the case of a DFS, I demanded that the system Hamiltonian should commute with A, with the associative algebra. And in fact, that's the general condition. We can see that from the representation theorem I just had. So we want the computation to never leave the DFS or the noiseless subsystem. And the question is, what logical operations are compatible? Well, if we look at the error algebra structure theorem again, what we should use as computational operations is exactly the dual of this. Right? So we want where the errors act as identity and which gives rise to the protected information, that's what we want to act in a non-trivial way. So the operations that are allowed as logical operations are exactly the commutant, the operators that commute with A, because those will have, immediately you can see, those will have this structure, right, where you have an M where there was an I, and you have an I where there was an M. These two objects commute. So this is called the commutant. So anything that lives in the commutant of the error algebra will give rise to logical operations that are compatible with preserving the structure of the noiseless subsystem. And there's a very important example of this, which I'll come back to later, and it's the example of exchange Hamiltonians, in particular the Heisenberg interaction that John mentioned in his talk in the morning. So it turns out that the Heisenberg interaction is compatible with a certain type of decoherence channel called collective decoherence, which I'll get to in a minute. And this realization had some important implications for quantum computing. Anyhow, this is the structure of the allowed operations. The allowed operations for given error algebra, the allowed operations are exactly the operations that belong to the commutant of that error algebra. Okay, so now let me give the canonical example of an error channel that gives rise to a DFS and noiseless subsystems. And it's the so-called collective decoherence model. So let's say that we have spins, and I drew two, but now let's imagine we have n of them. And rather than having just some long wavelength field along the z direction, we are also allowing fields along x and y. Okay, so think of these as long wavelength phonons, for example, at low temperature. So what's the corresponding error model? Well, for n qubits, the error model is that the system Bath Hamiltonian has this kind of structure. The system operators are the sum of all the qubit operators in a given direction, alpha. Alpha is x, y, or z. Okay, so you see that this is permutationally invariant under permuting the qubit labels, 1, 2, through n. So so here, the symmetry is permutation. And for this error model, this collective decoherence, I'm not making any claims as to how realistic it really is, except to say that at low temperatures we can expect long-wave phonons, but of course up to a limit. Okay. But anyhow, as a mathematical toy model, this is very nice because it indeed gives rise to a DFS and noiseless subsystems. We can also think of the error model in the language of CP maps. You can think of this as a map, as a CP map where you apply the same unitary to all the qubits along X, and another one along Y, another one along Z, with possibly with different probabilities. Okay, that's the same channel as the one that I just described in the Hamiltonian language. Okay, so now the theory tells us that we should do the analysis of the irreducible representations of this the algebra that's generated, which means that we have the algebra is the n-fold sum of SU2s, and SU2 is on a single qubit, but we have the n-fold sum thereof, and that's acting on n qubits, and that's a simple enough problem in angular momentum theory. And here's a nice graphical way to understand what the outcome is. So what I'm drawing here is the total angular momentum J for n spin 1/2 as a function of the number of qubits or spin 1/2 n. Okay, so what does angular momentum theory tell us? It tells us if we have zero spins, then there's nothing. But if we have one spin, its total angular momentum is 1/2. Right? It's a spin 1/2 particle. If we have two, then I can combine them so that the total angular momentum is either 0 or 1. Right? It's the 1/2 plus 1/2 or the 1/2 minus 1/2. So I have a path that goes this way or that way. And if I add a third spin, then again, from 0 I can add 1/2, and from 1 I can either subtract 1/2 or add 1/2. Okay, so in this way you build up this thing called the Bertelli diagram. And this maps out the entire Hilbert space of n spin 1/2. It gives you everything you need to know, because in particular the number of paths leading to a vertex on this diagram tells you exactly the degeneracy, tells you that number, the n sub j number. So for example, there's only one way to get to a single spin 1/2. It's one-fold degenerate. There are two ways to get to this point. So I can take this path, or I can take this path, and that will turn out to be important in a moment. It turns out, again, that this is, as I wrote it here, the multiplicity n sub j counts the paths, okay? And the dimension, the d sub j, is just, for spin 1/2, it's 2j plus 1. All right, so remember, the DFS case corresponded to the one-dimensional irreducible representations, which means the j should be 0. So the DFSs all lie along the axis here. That's the case where the total j is 0. All right, that gives you dj, d sub 0 equals 1. But it turns out that every point here on this diagram represents a noiseless subsystem. And what's the dimension of that noiseless subsystem? It's exactly the number of paths leading to it. So the simplest non-trivial example is right here. It's the singlet state, which again John mentioned at some point. The singlet state of two spin 1/2, I drew it diagrammatically as this path. Okay, that's the state 0, 1, minus 1, 0. This is a decoherence free state. It's a one-dimensional subspace. But look again at this point. As I said, there are two paths leading to this point, right? This one and this one, like that. So that means that we have a two-dimensional subsystem there, which can store a whole qubit, a whole encoded qubit. And if you want to write out what the states are in the computational basis, turns out this is what the states are. Okay, so this example is very important because it's the smallest noiseless qubit, smallest encoded, noiseless encoded qubit for collective decoherence. It needs three physical qubits, and out you get one encoded noiseless qubit. And here's another very important example. This is the smallest DFS qubit. Again, a DFS means that the degeneracy, so the dimension should be 1, so we're on the axis here, and you see there are two paths, this one and up, up, down, down. And these are the states that correspond to this qubit. Okay, so this gives us a DFS qubit. This gives us a noiseless subsystem qubit. And then we have the question of how we can compute over these structures. And as I mentioned before, we can use the Heisenberg exchange interaction to do it. I'm not going to go into the details. I can give you the reference here. But it turns out that if you want to compute over the 4-qubit DFS, so that's this one, right? So this is a one state, logical 0. This is logical 1. If you want to compute over this qubit, what does it mean to compute over this qubit? It means that you want to be able to implement logical X, logical Z, and a controlled knot, let's say. Okay, so it turns out that the following are the logical X and logical Z. The sum of exchanging physical qubits 1 and 3, so what I mean by EIJ is written here. It's just the Heisenberg operator between the SI dot SJ operator between physical qubits 1 and 3 plus half E1, 2. So exchange 1, 3 plus half of exchange 1, 2, that gives you logical X. So it's an easy exercise to check. And minus exchange 1, 2 gives you logical Z. So together, these two generate arbitrary single encoded qubit gates. Okay? And if you want to do a C naught between two of these logical qubits, so now imagine that you have 4 physical qubits here and another 4 here, and you want to do a C naught between the DFS qubit over this one and the DFS qubit over the other one, well, then it's a very complicated sequence of operations to do an encoded controlled knot. It involves 14 elementary steps involving these exchange operations, and the details you can find in Dave Bacon's PhD thesis. But now that there's an interesting outcome of this, which has nothing to do with DFSs necessarily and noiseless subsystems. John mentioned in his talk many efforts that people have undergone recently in order to implement single qubit operations on quantum dots. But several years ago, it was realized as a result of this work that actually we can compute in quantum dots, which have the Heisenberg exchange interaction, and remember the Heisenberg exchange interaction is fast, and that was the picosecond timescale interaction. It's very fast and it's very accurate. We can do everything in quantum dots using Heisenberg exchange. We can implement universal computation using Heisenberg exchange. We don't really need to address single spins in quantum dots. We can do everything using Heisenberg exchange, provided we encode over one of these codes. So that, in this sense, these codes are not used now to protect against decoherence. They're just used to enable, to simplify architectural constraints, if you wish, in quantum computation. So a concise way to put it is that the Heisenberg interaction is universal all by itself over noiseless subsystem qubits. Okay, so I wanted to, let me quickly go over this before the break. There was a question about the dimension of these DFSs and how big they really are, the noiseless subsystems. Well, here is the general formula for the dimension of the noiseless subsystem with whose angular momentum value is j on n physical qubits. So this is a combinatorial object which can be derived using Young diagrams and other techniques. It's a nice exercise to try to find this formula. This is nothing but the what I called n sub j before. Okay, so a little n sub j before. This is the degeneracy of the noiseless subsystem with angular momentum j and n physical qubits. So now you can define the rate of the code or the encoding efficiency, which is just a number of encoded qubits divided by the number of physical qubits, so it's like the number of qubits out divided by the number of qubits in. And if you take the case of a DFS where j equals 0, you get that asymptotically, as the number of physical qubits gets large, this fills up the whole space, which is somewhat surprising perhaps, but that's the result. So the states that lie along the axis, right, the DFS states, asymptotically, their dimension fills up the whole space minus a log n over n correction. So unfortunately, we don't have perfect collective decoherence in nature, usually. If we did, this would be a very nice place in which to encode quantum information, because you hardly lose anything. You might ask yourself, what about, this is SU2, what about SU3? Well, so this question was answered in this paper. And it turns out that if you were dealing with qutrits rather than qubits, and you had a collective decoherence model over qutrits, you can again do this analysis. And now there is no simple analytical formula, apparently, but numerically you can show that the fraction, this the very same fraction that I wrote down here, and there's some technicality about the three different congruence classes of D. D now is the dimension of the Hilbert space, modulo 3 for SU3, but the point is, all three of these congruence classes converge, and the fraction of the noiseless subsystems, the volume of the noiseless subsystems, that fraction converges to something like 0.9. Okay, and the limit of as the dimension of the Hilbert space gets large, or that's the same limit as taking the number of qubits here or qutrits here to be large. So this phenomenon that the noiseless subspaces fill up the whole Hilbert space seems to be general. Okay. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip the experiment, and you can ask me about it in the break if you wish. But I want to make one quick comment about symmetry breaking. It was pointed out that the assumption of a perfect symmetry is unrealistic. Of course, I agree. And so you can ask yourself, what happens if there is a symmetry breaking? And we're going to deal with it actively after the break. But for now, let's just deal with it passively. So if there is a symmetry breaking, let's say that the Hamiltonian whose symmetry is perfect, HSB, is now perturbed by some symmetry breaking term with strength epsilon. Okay, then what you can show, and it's shown in these papers, is that the fidelity of an encoded DFS state only depends on this epsilon parameter to second order. So the corrections are order epsilon squared. The first order correction vanishes. So a DFS has a stability property, and this was actually shown experimentally in this paper here by Paul Kwiatz's team. And without explaining anything, I'll just tell you that the fact that you see that the green line here looks quadratic here and here, this is the DFS state. It's the singlet state, the HV minus VH. It's like 0, 1, minus 1, 0. That's the one singlet state. You see that it is stable around the symmetry breaking point. This point is the perfect symmetry point here and here. This is as a function of an angle between two polarizing plates, and here it's as a function of the strength of the decoherence channel and in terms of the thickness of these plates. You see that around the symmetry point, the symmetry breaking only happens to second order. Okay, so that confirms the theoretical prediction. But of course, we can have stronger symmetry breaking, and that's what happened in this NIST experiment, where they encoded into the singlet state of a pair of ions, and checked whether that encoding was robust against decoherence. And what they saw was that the encoding improved upon the decay rate of unencoded qubits. So these are the unencoded qubits, these are the DFS encoded qubits, and this is some kind of a measure of coherence. And you see it's a logarithmic scale. So coherence decays exponentially, but it decays more slowly in the DFS case as opposed to the not DFS case. So in this case, where there was no, this was not engineered noise. This is real noise. So the DFS encoding somehow picked out a symmetric component in the noise and therefore improved the coherence time a little bit, but not enough because it's still exponentially decaying. So this is a case of strong symmetry breaking. So the message here is, well, it's useful probably to encode into a DFS, but it's not the end of the story when you're facing real non-symmetric noise. Okay, so we need a way to deal with symmetry breaking, and let you go have a break first.